And you're listening to Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Stort, and for the next hour, you will be listening to good information about health and natural medicine. And because it's the day after the primary, probably some of that too. So let's jump right in. We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. Ron will be here shortly to take your calls. And you can also write to me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. And if you text me at 860-486-9487, I will see your text and I will be able to answer your questions. So I'd love to answer your questions. But in the meantime, I will give you some ideas about some of the things that I would like you to know about. So first of all, something interesting jumped out at me yesterday. I was noodling around and found that there was a study that was published in Psychology Today that dogs don't like to be hugged. Who knew? They really don't. And I kind of understand it. It says from this recent study that hugging a dog actually stresses the dog out, which in some cases can cause the animal to bite. And here's the deal. Dogs, the way that dogs are wired, they are their primary way to fight is to escape a threat. Their first instinct is to run away. And they have to be able to run away. And they're very good runners. They have four legs. They're built for running. So getting away from something fast is a good thing. So when you put your arms around a dog, even though it's loving and bonding and stuff, the dog actually feels stressed because the dog starts to feel cornered. And because I'm assuming just because the dog is polite, the dog doesn't necessarily do anything. So because most dogs, if your dog considers itself bonded to you, it's going to let you do what you want to it. And it's not going to feel super threatened. But if you hug the dog too much, it's actually ultimately going to upset the dog. And they said there are ways that you can tell that the dog is actually stressed. And this researcher took photos of various dogs being hugged by people who love them or people who own them, and said you could show the signs of being stressed, that the dogs open their eyes wider so you can see little crescent moons. Basically, you see part of the whites of their eyes, so they look like little crescent moons. That crescent moon is a sign of stress. The dog is opening its eyes wider to look for danger. The dog will do stress yawning. You know, it's trying to get more oxygen because it's thinking about running away. And the dog will wriggle a little bit, and it will put its ears back. And it's because it doesn't actually like to be hugged that much. And I can kind of relate to that. Not that I don't like to be hugged, but in the wrong circumstances, I don't, which is very strange.
Should I be careful when you put your ears back?
Yeah, I can't do that. But if I'm on a mission and you have to stop me and hug me, it drives me nuts. And because I live in a touchy-feely, huggy community, it happens to me. And if I'm on a mission, I'm like, get away from me. Just get out. I got to keep going, you know. And so I think I upset some people who they have a paradigm that hugging is good. And if you won't let me hug you, you're missing out on something. You should really be letting me hug you. And I'm like, well, I want to be hugged when I want to be hugged. And if I'm on a mission, don't hug me. That sounds really sad for the radio naturopath to be saying, right? But
yes,
it's kind of true. I can understand that. And if you have any kind of a history where you felt trapped and you couldn't get away from something, like if you have an abuse history, then it can lead to that, where you feel like you're cornered, and you feel like if you have that sensation that you can't get away, it's not a good feeling. And you have to be in a place where you're really relaxed and you're feeling like, all right, I'm not on a mission to get somewhere. And then you can relax and enjoy the hug. And it is true that people and canines like to be touched. I mean, if you see puppies, they climb all over each other. They don't sleep separately. They bond to each other. It's well known that when humans and dogs bond, there's oxytocin produced on either end. And oxytocin, of course, is the bonding hormone. When you hug or when you touch or when you even just hold hands with your partner, you produce oxytocin, which is bonding hormone. And certainly, if I allow myself to relax and enjoy a hug, I will do that. But that bonding, if that's contrary, if I'm producing that bonding hormone and it's contrary to my feeling of the need to get somewhere, then it doesn't really work. And dogs in general, dogs' instinct is, their first instinct is I don't want to be cornered. But most dogs, if a dog is bonded to its owner or bonded to a little child, they're not going to lash out. They're not going to bite. But if you hug them too long or if they feel too restrained, they might. So it's kind of interesting. And so this is a new thing. So you may not want to hug your dog. If you're going to hug your dog, you might just want to don't surround them with your whole body. And be respectful of them because dogs do like they do like to be petted and they do like belly rubs and they do like to touch you. They do like to be near you and licking. That's the other thing about that's interesting about licking with dogs, because when we had Nala, Nala was a licker. So I decided to read up on licking, and licking is not just kissing. It can be. I mean, dogs will lick they'll lick animals that they feel like they're taking care of. So if you see a big dog licking a small puppy or licking their own puppy or licking a small animal that they're bonding with, they're doing that in a caring way. That's clear. But if your dog is licking otherwise, if your dog is licking you and you're not particularly a tiny baby, the dog is licking. Dogs lick for information. They're trying to figure out what's going on because taste is part of how they sense their environment. They have very strong senses of taste and smell, and they lick to find out what's going on. So if a dog feels insecure, a dog will lick you. And if you don't like to be licked and the dog wants to lick you to find out what's going on, and you try to not let the dog lick you, dog's going to lick you more. Dog's going to want to lick you more because dog feels insecure. Licking is a behavior of insecurity. If you go to the dog and you pet them and you honor them and you invite them into their environment, you make them feel secure, they're going to lick you less. It's really interesting. So I used to not mind it if Nala licked me, so I don't know that she licked me as much. I mean, she would lick me for a while and then she would stop, but other people didn't like licking her, so she had a lick issue because she was a licker. And so when you stop a dog from licking, they get nervous because now they can't use their senses to get the information about the environment that they need. So you have to give them space. So this is a really interesting lesson. All our lives we thought, oh, sure, dogs are really affectionate and they love to be hugged. They don't really. They tolerate it. And like I said, the way you'll know is you'll see the whites of their eyes. They'll pin their ears back. They'll yawn. They'll lick. Those are signs that they're not entirely comfortable with it. And then ultimately, they wriggle away from you. But they do like to be petted, and they do like to have their bellies rubbed, and there are things that they do like. So what's interesting about this is you can't make assumptions about what people and animals want, and that if you make an assumption that what's good for me is good for you, it's not a useful assumption to make. That when you're dealing with people and dogs, that when you step in, you can't speculate about what a person wants. When you go in, you have to be kind of tabula rasa, a clean slate. You don't know what that person or that animal wants. And you have to you have to give them space and let them let you know what's going on. Don't make assumptions. It was kind of really interesting lesson because this was big in the news. I was reading it last night and I see it again. It was in Psychology Today, so that's why it's coming out in the news. So there you go. So it's very interesting. All right. So do get a hold of us. If you would like to participate in any kinds of conversations today, you can give us a call. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You are listening to Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM. Home of the world-famous Yukon Huskies. And did you know that Gino Auriemma is, in fact, coaching the women's Olympic basketball team? He was on the Today Show today.
How about that?
Yep, he was on the Today Show along with the women's basketball team because they were highlighting all of the American Olympic sports teams. And so the women's Olympic basketball team made an appearance along with Gino, and Brianna Stewart's on it, and Sue Bird and Diana Taurasi. Diana Taurasi and Angel McCautry, Brittany Griner, and one other were not there because they're in Europe right now playing for their teams in Europe. They're their professional teams. But others who were in the States were there today. Tina Charles is going to be on the team. So a bunch of UConn alums. Brianna Stewart, Tina Charles, Maya Moore, Sue Bird, and Diana Taurasi. Not sure if there's another one, too. But a lot of UConn alums and Angel McCautry, Brittany Griner. It's like a who's who of women's basketball. It's really incredible.
It's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think they can lose. I don't think it's possible for them to lose. And Gino's coaching. So what are you going to do with that? I just don't know. So it's going to be it'll be an amazing thing. And they'll make us proud yet again. So, all right. So what else is going on in the world? Let's see. So Ron wanted me to talk about allergies a little bit, and even though we talk about allergies a lot, but it is, in fact, you know, it's an important thing to talk about. And let's see if we can get some facts about pollen right now. Because pollen is definitely an issue right now. And what I like to do, what I like to do when I'm looking at pollen, there is a place you can go on. There's a few places you can go online, but I use WeatherBug on my phone, and you can also go to pollen.com. That's very easy, and you can plug in your zip code, and they will tell you what's going on allergy wise for pollen. So yesterday, there was a very low pollen count. And why might that be? That's because it rained most of the day. So rain will wash the pollen out of the air. It's just the pollen just can't suspend in the air because all that water's coming down and washing it down. Today, however, there's a lot of pollen in the air. And there's a high pollen count, and it's trees. And the top allergens here in stores are ash, poplar, and birch. So the neat thing about pollen is if you clean it out of your nose, you're going to have better success with it. And cleaning it out of your nose is a good way to go because pollen is interesting because pollen will cause an immune response. But pollen is sort of a fellow traveler. It just sort of hangs out in your nose. It catches a ride on you so it can get to the next flower so that it can pollinate it. It's not particularly interested in living in your body. It's not advantageous for it to stay in your body. It's advantageous for you to get it on you and then go to the next plant and carry it to another plant so it can pollinate that plant. This is very different from dust and dust mites, which we are part of its life cycle, because dust mites eat our skin. And so because we're part of its life cycle.
Vicious little creatures.
Oh, I know. Oh. And so one of the things is remember that you have the bucket. You have the bucket. Think of a bucket.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the top of the bucket is your threshold for getting symptoms. So if the bucket is full and overflowing, then you're going to have symptoms. If you can beat back allergies wherever you can, you might be less reactive. So believe it or not, one way to combat allergies in the environment, when you know the high pollen count outdoors, is to get rid of dust and mold in your house. So if your house is dusty and moldy, then you would do well still dust, mold, and if you have issues with pets, to get rid of those allergens and make sure that your bed is clear. The bed is ground zero for allergens. The bed is the most important place to keep clean and get the allergens away. So dust covers for your pillows, changing your pillowcases twice a week, changing your sheets at least weekly, and you know, cleaning your bedding every 2 to 4 weeks. So that's your blankets and covers. But the stuff that's closest to your face is the pillows and the pillowcases. And so you've got the dust mites eating the skin cells that are sloughed off your face, and then they poop. And then you have dust mite poop, which has protein, DNA, and bacteria. You breathe that in, and that's what's the most that's the most allergenic thing that we breathe in. Dust mites are worse than any of the tree pollen that's out there. in general. Because I know, because I test people, I do IgE allergy testing on people, and I find that their antibodies, so their immune systems, fight with the dust mites more than they fight with anything else. And part of the reason is because we're exposed to it. We're exposed to it all year. And so we have lots more time to develop a lot more antibodies to it. And we're only exposed to tree pollen for a short portion of the year. We're definitely being exposed to it right now, this minute.
Boy, are we ever.
Yes. So, I mean, it starts now and it goes the entire month of May and then into June. And so that's really interesting. So if you want to try to use honey to help you with your allergens, it's something you can do. That it's folk medicine. So I don't know that it's been studied, but there are people who report when they eat local honey, they feel better. Mm-hmm. And the idea, I think it's because there's flavonoids. I don't know how much of it is because there's actual little bits of allergens in the honey. So if you're buying honey now, that honey may have been collected by bees months ago. So, maybe last fall's honey. So if it's helping you, it's not because the bees are collecting pollen from the trees now. If you can get honey from, current honey that's being made now, that might be even better for that. But I bought this beautiful honey from a local local beekeeper, that was extremely dark. It was very, very dark brown. And it looked so beautiful that I bought some. And this is a local honey guy, George Bailey. He's over on Crane Hill Road. Saw him at the polls yesterday. And you see him at the farmer's market, the store's farmer's market, which, by the way, will have its first outdoor market on May the 7th.
Yep.
So you can go there. It'll be back at back in front of Town Hall.
That's right.
Yep. In stores. And so his honey was really, really dark. And I asked George if he knew why. And he said, I don't know. It's just what the bees been collecting. So I looked it up to see what was going on there. And my theory was that the darker the honey, the more antioxidants are in it. Because that's how it generally goes for other things. You know, if black beans have more antioxidants than white beans.
Dark leafy greens.
Dark leafy greens and dark berries. You know, blackberries and strawberries and raspberries.
Dark wine.
Blueberries. That's right. Grape skins. You got it. They have more antioxidants. So is this true of honey too? And I looked it up and yeah, it is. So there's going to be more flavonoids and antioxidants in dark honey because of wherever the bees collected the pollen from.
It's because the bees know that we need help.
Yes.
So they're taking care of us.
It was taking care of us. Mm-hmm. And it's really amazing because I bought that honey versus honey I've seen other places. It's so much darker. And then a friend of mine keeps bees in Coventry, and he gave me honey where he didn't do anything to it. He just took it off the hive. He left the honeycomb in, and he didn't heat it or anything. He just whammed it in a jar with the honeycomb in it. And I've been enjoying that a great deal. I've been putting that in my tea, and that honey. So it's got beeswax in it. So it's got, because it's really, really unrefined. And sometimes I'll just pull out pieces of the beeswax and chew on it until the honey's out of it. And then I'm just chewing on wax. And even though eating the beeswax, I'm not sure, there's a lot of good stuff in beeswax. There's antimicrobial compounds and immune compounds in beeswax. But I don't know how well your body pulls apart wax. So I don't tend to want to eat. Once I've chewed out the honey.
It probably doesn't digest real well.
Yeah. So once I chew out the honey, I tend to spit out the wax, which seems kind of a waste. But the thing is, that honey still has wax all through it. So I am eating some of the wax when I ingest some of the honey. And then when I put it in my tea, the wax will float in my tea. And it's totally cool. So I got a couple of honeys going on. And so the thing is, too, if you want to get the best benefit from the honey and you want to get all the flavanols, you really can't put it in hot tea or in hot beverages or in food that's currently hot because you'll inactivate some of the enzymes and some of the compounds that are helping your immune system in that tea. So I tend to stir the honey into yogurt. And I'll use it on other things. And stirring it into yogurt is great because then it's not going to be heated up at all. So that's a really great thing. So honey, cleaning your nose out, keeping your sheets clean, herbs like nettles and eye bright. Those can be really helpful, whether you have them in tea or whether you have them in tinctures or pills or caps. Horseradish is another great one. Horseradish and elder both can also be helpful for allergies. Horseradish tends to really open up your sinus passages. And spicy food in general, cayenne, also is going to tend to open up your sinuses. Really, really good stuff. I also like bromelain. Bromelain is an enzyme from pineapples that is a proteolytic enzyme. It tends to break down proteins, and so inflammatory compounds are proteins, in fact. And you can, so using bromelain can be helpful as well. Vitamin C, good old vitamin C. So whether you eat vitamin C in your food by eating citrus, or a good thing is berries. The berries are starting to come domestically now. And strawberries are really high in vitamin C, and so are rose hips, but so is broccoli, and so are peppers. So you can get vitamin C in your food, and you can also take vitamin C pills. Vitamin C strengthens the lining of your respiratory passages and makes it so that it has more integrity. So it's going to be more impervious to pollen and other allergens that are going to come into your system. The other thing is sugar. Sugar is inflammatory. If you're eating a lot of sweets, you tend to get more inflammation. It's how, because you raise your insulin when you have sugar, and your sugar, and so the insulin causes more inflammatory compounds to be around. And sugar also causes dysbiosis, and it causes dysbiosis in all tissues. So you're going to get more unfriendly bacteria in your digestive system, and you're also going to get more unfriendly bacteria in your respiratory tract if you eat too much sugar. And those cause inflammation, and you're going to have more symptoms. So if you fast on sugar, take sugar out of your diet, try it for a week if you can, and you'll find that you might have less allergy symptoms. So it's a
good thing. Little piece there on the beeswax too, just so you know. Ingesting beeswax is not a recommended procedure, and it's great to use for making lip balms. It's great to use for making candles
topically,
and things like that. It has been known to cause some intestinal blockage.
Right, so it can make beezoars.
Right. Well, it doesn't dissolve.
It doesn't. Right. It doesn't digest.
It doesn't digest,
and
well,
it
so
stops.
You don't get a blockage. So
that's
you want to be a little careful about
with
that
the
sort
beeswax.
Of thing.
So
you
chewing,
can chew on it. That's fine.
And
but
then spit it out.
Spit it out afterwards. Yeah.
Right.
That's all.
Yeah. So that's what I was wondering. Just the nature of wax.
Mm-hmm.
What's in a wax? It's not, we don't have enzymes really that break down a wax. That was my concern,
right,
that we don't really have enzymes that break down waxes.
And if you think about it, we use wax to seal things.
Yes.
You know, so if you're using a wax to seal something, you're basically, it means it can't be broken down by liquids.
Right.
So,
that's right.
So, you know, you're going to, probably the same as far as digestive
so
liquids.
Do you know what a beezoar is?
A beezoar.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm about to learn.
Oh, boy. A beezoar is a blockage in your intestine that's made of foreign matter, and it's just a blockage. It's in and of itself, it can be harmless or harmful depending on what's in it. But you could get a beezoar made from
beeswax.
Beeswax beezoar. And the unfortunate thing is that the wax is sticky. So mm-hmm. other things can stick to it.
Yeah.
That's really bad.
So it's going to collect things
in there.
I think
there was a House episode once where somebody had a beezoar, and the beezoar was a collection of stuff. There might have been wax. There might have been hair. There was stuff in there that shouldn't have been there. But the other thing is the person was swallowing pills. They were taking a drug.
Hmm.
And the drug got caught up in the beezoar. So it was randomly letting out. So you have all these pills that are caught in this beezoar. And they were randomly letting out random doses of this drug. So this person was getting all these wacky symptoms, and they couldn't figure out why. And that was why. They had a beezoar that had drugs
like
in it.
Sounds like a rare issue.
Yes. Well, you know, when we used to watch House used to look for the zebra, and he would usually find it. That was just the nature of that show. If you want weird medical things going on, watch House. So we've got your ash, your popular and your perch. So this is the thing, too. If you're very allergic to trees, if you find that you suffer from the tree pollen a lot, unfortunately, opening the window may not be the best idea unless you have filters and air exchangers in your house. On the one hand, you like to open the window because you get the nice fresh air in. But on the other hand, if you let the pollen in, that's not going to do you much good. So you may have to close the windows and filter your air. Filtering your air, we love the HEPA filter. HEPA filters are great ideas because they do tend to filter the pollen out of the air, and that can be something that's really helpful. And you can buy HEPA filters and place them in various strategic rooms in your house. I especially recommend them for the bedroom because, again, you're a sitting duck for you're a sitting duck for pollen when you're sitting deck for dust when you're in your bedroom when you're sleeping. So if you can pull the dust out of the air, that can be really helpful. All right. So when Ron is taking a phone call right now, and when he gets off, we'll do a recap of the election a little bit, because Ron worked as a moderator in the town of Mansfield at one of the polling places. So we wanted to take this opportunity because one of the principles of naturopathic medicine is the idea of prevention, and encompassed in the idea of prevention is the idea that we need to have a healthy environment, an environment in which you can do your healing. And so I believe that having fair politics is part of that. If you have unhealthy, unfair politics, you can't feel safe and comfortable, and that's a source of stress. And so this whole political process is very exciting, and it's stressful to some people. So I think I want to talk about it because, we're trying to have a healthy country and trying to heal our country, and our politics is part of that. So when he gets off, we'll talk about that. In the meantime, this is interesting. So there's a whole ball of wax, hot mess, as my teacher Tori Hudson said when I was at the conference about a month ago, in terms of mammograms. Mammograms, they're depending on the organization, there are recommendations that you should get them yearly, that you should get them every other year, that you should get them based on what your risk is, on whether the radiation can increase your chances for problems with your breasts. And when you receive letters describing what's going on with your mammogram, they can be confusing. So when you get a mammogram done, as a lot of you women realize, you get a letter telling you what's going on, and they may tell you, well, your mammogram is normal, there are no suspicious masses, and you have some percentage of fibroglandular tissue, and you might see fatty replacement depending on where you are in your life and what your results are. It will also tell you if you have dense breasts. So according to this article from Modern Readers, it says that some states actually have passed laws to make the letters that you receive after your mammogram less or easier to understand. So there was a study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which focused on notification letters that mainly inform women about breast density, which is a known breast cancer risk. So if you have very dense breasts, you may have a higher risk of cancer because you have more tissue that is estrogen sensitive. I believe that's why. The study claims that the language used in some mammogram notifications is unusually highfalutin. That is it's a technical term, and it's only understandable to doctors, because you get this letter back. It says you have dense breasts. So what does that mean? So it says that your breast has connective and fibrous tissue, which can raise cancer risk and also obscure tumors that may be found on mammograms. But even so, if your breasts are dense, they're not an automatic sign that you have breast cancer. Dense breasts simply are a sign that you have more estrogenic tissue, and also that your dense tissue can obscure masses, like they said. So 20% of the population only reads at an eighth grade level. Really? And many more don't read much higher than that, said Nancy Creston of the Boston University School of Medicine. For many women, these notifications are not going to be easy to read and might even be alarming. We've talked to some women who received the letters, and the reaction was, oh, my God, I have cancer. So people think they have cancer when they don't. So It says if your mammogram demonstrates that you have dense breast tissue, which could hide small abnormalities, you might benefit from supplementary screening tests, which can include a breast ultrasound screening or a breast MRI examination or both, depending on your individual risk factors. So this is the thing. If you get a mammogram and you get a letter back and it has confusing language in it and you're not sure how to proceed, you need to have a talk with your gynecologist or with your doctor, who will sit down with you and sort it out and tell you what they think. And that's what I would do. If somebody came back to me with a concerning mammogram, and I would have to read the mammogram report and see what it said, and then I would give you further instructions. And if a woman is very anxious, I might order an ultrasound for her regardless, because ultrasounds are inexpensive. And I can do it at my discretion. And ultrasounds can sometimes see things that that mammograms cannot. So if you do an ultrasound, not a biopsy ultrasound, because you don't know that there's a tumor in there, ultrasounds are very they're much more tolerable than mammograms. Mammograms, you guys, now men can have mammograms. Sometimes they have to get them because if a tumor is palpated, men have to get them too. But women get mammograms, and it's this bizarre situation. You have to put your breast on a platform, and then it gets mushed. Mm. They squash it.
It's a sandwich.
So they can see. It's very strange, and it's not entirely comfortable.
It's a stainless steel sandwich.
And the more sensitive your breasts are and the smaller they are, the more it hurts. It actually is painful. So a lot of women don't look forward to it.
Mm.
Anyway, getting a breast ultrasound is not nearly as stressful. Now, some women, they don't want to be messed with altogether. So the ultrasound, I want to honor that the ultrasound's not going to be pleasant for them either. But a breast ultrasound, you put ultrasound gel on the breast and you have a wand, and it's not nearly as it's not nearly as invasive.
Just like when you're looking for a baby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very similar,
same idea.
Except you're doing it on the breast. Mm-hmm. And so you know, it's not this terrible thing to go have it done. And, you know, it doesn't hurt, and you can have a nice chat with the ultrasound tech, and they look for stuff, and then they have a report, and then you plan to do what's next. But that's really interesting, because I have seen these letters come back, and what has happened, in my estimation, in the years I've been practicing medicine, is that mammograms themselves have gotten so accurate that they see things. And they see things that could be nothing, and women wind up going through a lot more screening procedures that could be expensive but are also alarming to the woman. And it could turn out that they saw a shadow and they went through a series of tests and the shadow turned out to be nothing. And that happens. And it happens more than you would think, and it would have to happen more than you would think, because most women don't have breast cancer. You know, a significant percentage do, but most women don't. And so because most women don't get breast cancer and will never get breast cancer, there can be a lot of women who are being screened and have alarming and ultimately, you don't want to say unnecessary, because for all the women that got unnecessary, you know, so-called unnecessary screenings, there's a certain percentage of women who you're going to catch breast cancer early and they're going to be saved from death. So, you know, what are you going to do? I think the answer is just to make screening inexpensive and available to everyone, and then it wouldn't be an issue. You just go get screened, and that's it.
And maybe some better knowledge and self-examination, too, just so you know what to look for.
Yes.
Or at least get an idea of when you should go in and be screened.
Right. Right. Well, and you have to have, you do self-examination, and practitioner do a clinical breast exam, and you kind of have to do all of these things, because you sometimes can find things that imagery misses, and imagery can find things that you miss. So having all of these things available to you is a good idea. So and Tori Hudson was very interesting, because I saw Tori Hudson, and Tori Hudson is probably the gynecologist on the planet that I respect more than anything else, because she respects the latest in gynecological research, and she's a naturopathic physician. And so she is she's my gynecology power animal. She Skype lectured at the CNPA conference, so it was great to see her. And she herself said that mammography is a hot mess right now, because there's so many different recommendations, there's so many different ideas of what should be done, and there's so many different ways to do screening between ultrasounds, needle biopsy, ultrasound guided, MRI, breast MRIs, and three-dimensional mammography. and they catch things that you didn't used to catch.
Yeah.
And so what you should be doing and when, and then you base that on what you observe clinically, as well as, you know, what your family history and your risk factors are.
So when they do a mammogram, is there radiation involved?
Yeah, mammogram is
so
an X-ray.
Doesn't that kind of like open a possible can of worms?
Yes.
Is that why we call it a hot mess?
That's part of the hot mess.
Yeah.
That is true, because you're exposing
the
breast to radiation.
Like, you know, you're going to have things checked out, but at the same time, it's the same thing in dental, too, I guess, the same
absolutely.
Idea. Absolutely. You know, because you're exposing yourself to radiation,
yes,
which could then therefore cause a problem.
Right,
so.
It's ionizing radiation, absolutely. Yeah. There's a risk associated with that. Why do you think the dental hygienist runs out of the room when she pushes the button?
Oh, yeah, that always makes me a little nervous.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm involved with an explosion of some sort.
Well, you think she puts a lead apron on you, I hope.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then a big lead piece in your mouth and the whole, you know, there's a whole protective procedure. I understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
But it does make you kind of go, is this right? You
right. Know? Right. I mean, I would say less X-rays is more. You know, the X-rays X-rays can find things, but X-rays are ionizing radiation.
Right. So. And, you know, I usually get them once a year because they're always looking.
They're looking for your teeth.
For cavities
and
things, you know, developments and problems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's interesting. So, like I said, if you get a letter from your doctor or from a mammography and it doesn't make sense to you or you're concerned, then you go schedule an appointment with your doctor. Your doctor will explain it to you and will help you to make the next step. So there you go. All right. So why don't we talk about so Ron, we have you on. It's advantageous that we have you here because you actually worked on the Board of Elections for the town of Mansfield.
I did.
And you were a moderator for which district?
For District 4.
Yes, for District 4. And you guys voted at the Annie Vinton School.
That's correct.
And so what was it like being a moderator yesterday?
Well, it's interesting. I've never been a moderator before. I've been a checker and I've been a tabulator and I've done, you know, a number of different duties. I've also been an assistant registrar. So I've done pretty much all the different tasks that are involved with being there on election day when people come in to vote and kind of know how it all works. And they sent me off to moderator training this year and I learned how to become a moderator. And that's... So I got to do that, and I got to see it from a different light. And I would say that best way to explain what a moderator is I would say they're the general manager of the situation that day. So that's kind of what they do. They overlook everyone and make sure that everyone is doing their duties, educate the people that you have working for you, because mostly what you have, we have a lot of volunteers. And by the way, if you're really interested in this election process, here's a little broadcast and shout out. We are always looking for volunteers. So if you want to volunteer a part of your day, all of your day, you don't have to volunteer your whole day. You really don't have to do that. But we're always looking. And you go to your local town hall and you go to the registrar of voters office and you sign up as a, you know what, I would like to be asked the next time. And, you know, put your name in. Put your name in the hat. And It's not hard when you get to your polling place. If you've never been a checker before or if you've never been a tabulator before, your registrar, your moderator will explain to you what the job is, and they will place you in that job, and you'll just, you know, go there and be friendly and greet people and you know, just kind of watch the whole process. Really interesting work because you get to see so many people.
Yeah.
And you get to see all different people from all different areas. I saw so many people I haven't seen for years.
Wow.
Yesterday, that just, you know, people that were in my life years ago, and there they are, they're voting now, and they're in this particular district, which I don't normally see them on election day because I'm usually in a different district. So it's kind of fascinating work. It's really kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
And we're busy, and it's a long day for a moderator. I'll throw out the warning for the moderators and the assistant registrars. It's a very long day for those folks.
And yesterday was your birthday.
And yesterday was my birthday, yes.
Yeah, so you had to moderate on your birthday. The primary fell on your birthday.
Yes, it did.
That's what happens. Stuff like that happens if your birthday falls on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just take my birthday off.
Yeah, I usually do too.
Yeah.
And that's generally the plan, is to take my birthday off and then ride my bicycle my age on my birthday in miles. And yesterday would have been not such a pleasant day because it was raining.
Yeah.
So that would, you know, it kind of worked out because I got my birthday ride in a couple of weekends before.
Right, we had to
with
do it
you
real
and,
early.
And with John and Beth and Bill.
Yeah.
And we had a really really nice ride, pleasant ride. So, you know, I just did it another time. So I still plugged in my 61 miles. So
yeah. So let's talk. Let's give a little bit of voice because, like I said, I think that the environment that we live in affects how we live, and that's a naturopathic principle, that our environment, and our environment as overseen by politicians that we elect, contributes to the quality of our life, which contributes to our health. So that's my justification for talking about the primary a little bit, because this is a very historic time.
Well, and it's a stressful time for people.
Yes.
You could see that yesterday. There were some people that were voting for the first time. We had a woman there who was, she's been living in the United States for a long time, but she recently became a U.S. citizen. This is her first time voting. And there's a whole process that she had to go through with paperwork and all. And unfortunately, there was some confusion with her paperwork, and it didn't work out as well for her, but she'll be all set for the presidential election. But there's a lot of anxiety there because it's a first time. Or you'll have a young voter who just signed up to become a voter because they're, you know, 17 or 18 years of age. And depending on their age, when they're going to be at a certain age for the presidential election, if they're going to be 18 by then, they could still vote in a primary younger. There's a lot of rules. But first time, and so you see some excitement, and then you see some, you know, some people get very anxious. And then, of course, the primary in the state of Connecticut, other states are different, but in the state of Connecticut, you have to be registered with a party in order to, affiliated with a party in order to vote in a primary. So you have to be affiliated with one of the two parties, the current parties, Democrat or Republican Party. And there were some very disappointed people that showed up, and understandably so. They showed up and they were, you know, they couldn't vote because they were unaffiliated or independent. And because of that, they do not get a chance to vote in the primaries. They can still vote in the general elections, but they can't vote in the primaries. So we had to turn away a number of people that were unaware of that. So There's
and
little
how do,
news.
And how do they get to be unaware of that?
Well, that's a really good question. I don't really know, because when you fill out your registration to vote, there's a couple of check boxes on there. You can check off either Democrat or Republican or unaffiliated.
Mm-hmm.
That's your call. But I don't know that it's really well explained as to what that does. We did a lot of explaining yesterday.
Yes.
So you learn, unfortunately, the hard way.
That's no good.
But
I don't think that's acceptable.
Well, it's a communication problem, and it needs to be resolved. I mean, you know, with every system, as you work within the system, you see the general flaws and things that could be made better.
So there are certain things that everybody knows about. Everybody knows Prince died. See that little that purple pipe cleaner that's on your mic
that.
There?
Yeah. There's
Everybody
purple.
Knows Prince died. There's Everybody knew when Michael Jackson died.
Right.
Everybody knew that Beyonce's Lemonade dropped. Okay?
Not everybody.
All right, not everybody.
Okay.
But
yeah.
A lot of people, I'll bet you that there are people who knew that Beyonce's Lemonade dropped who didn't know that they had to be registered in a certain way in order to be able to vote in the primary. So why not use some of those same channels to communicate that information? Why weren't there big flashes on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter? Listen, people, if you wanna be able to register to vote, this is how it works.
Well, first of all, there
needs to be a lot of public service. Why aren't there public service announcements way in advance? And you have to hit a lot of places. This makes me wonder if it's by design. You know, I just wonder.
Well, there's some things that are by design. And this is a very interesting situation, too, because if you are, you know, the primaries are all over the place. They're all at different times of the year.
Yes.
And
that's confusing, too.
Well, and you must be registered a certain time period before the primary, or else you will not be eligible to vote.
Right.
So if you had decided last week that you were going to switch over and become a Democrat or a Republican, you wouldn't have been able to vote.
Right.
Because there's a time period that you have to go through. So, yes, by design, absolutely. Denise Merrill is working on that here in the state of Connecticut.
I think that shouldn't be that way.
She really doesn't. Yeah, she doesn't think so either.
I think
so,
it should be at
so
any
So there are,
you should
you
be
know,
able
there
to
are people
at any
that are
minute.
Looking to change those laws.
Yeah.
But that is the law, and that's the way it works.
And the law was in place, and people didn't know about it, and then they couldn't vote.
Right, and they're upset.
So
they're
their right to
upset.
Vote, their right to vote was taken away.
So,
and you can say, oh, well, they should have known. Should they have? Because I'm a big believer in the four questions. Is it true? Can you be absolutely certain it's true? Who do you, how do you feel when you think that thought? Who would you be if you dropped that thought? They should know. They don't know. Why, instead of, you, when you say you should have known this, that is the, that is one of the most useless sentences ever, ever, okay? You as the person who's saying you should have known this, you're part of the problem because you're not being a problem solver. I can't stand it when people aren't problem solvers, when people would rather like beat up on people, insult people, be mean to people than say, oh, this happened. How could we have made it different?
Mm-hmm.
So you troubleshoot. So I hear this and I go, all right, these people didn't know. How is it they didn't know? And how could they have known? What would have been a way to get them to know? What are some avenues by which they get their information so they could have been told?
Right. And my crew, I, by the way, I had a fabulous crew yesterday. I had amazing people that volunteered, great time, and I thank them all for being there. They really did a spectacular job yesterday.
Uh-huh.
We, considering some of the bumps we ran into, just no one could have handled it better. Great crew. And what we did when someone would come to us and be upset about the situation, because it's obviously an upsetting situation, is we had registration cards there, and they could change right then and there. They could fill that out, and then we brought them back to the registrar's office, and now they will be, for the next election, they will be registered in a political party. But we were very nice about it. I said, we didn't demean them for, why didn't you know?
Right.
You know, we didn't
you
do that.
You should never do that ever to anyone.
We simply said, look, we're terribly sorry. This is the system. This is the way it works. I feel very badly that you can't do this today. But if you want to avoid this in the future, here's what we need to do. And you hand them the form. And most of them sat there, filled everything out, showed us their ID. We checked over their paperwork to make sure it was correct. And then we filed it right up here at the town hall. And now they don't have to worry about it the next time. And
right.
They'll be all set.
That's great.
There's also a big shout out here, because we ran into this problem often with student activity. Now, I didn't have a lot of student activity at my polling place because it's far
not
from
a student
university.
Place.
Just one right up here in Stores. That's where we get a lot more of the students. And I can only imagine that they got a tremendous amount of this. A lot of the younger people sign up online.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing you do. You sign up online.
Right.
And again, where's the awareness to, I need to be affiliated with a political party? There are also a lot of younger people right now who are not interested in being affiliated with either party because they're not really happy with either party and they don't have any beliefs or values to either of those
parties. And then they can't vote in the primary.
But then they're boxed out of the primary, so they have a problem. Unless, of course, you're in a state like Rhode Island, which allowed
unaffiliated
voters to vote in the primary. And the results of the election in states like Rhode Island and states like Washington and states like Oregon were phenomenally different because the unaffiliated voters were allowed to vote, like way different. And it's a really interesting perspective on how people think. And so, yes, there is party control here. And you know, this is a political issue. This is a big political issue because party control is basically keeping people, it's keeping the voice of America from speaking.
Yeah.
Okay, I said it.
Yeah.
So, you know, we have a problem with party control. It's a big problem.
Or we need more parties.
Or we need to be able to allow everyone to vote on a primary.
That too.
Because then you get a much better idea of what the general opinion is here in the United States on our current political situation. And I can tell you, by those states that allow open voting for all unaffiliated parties, that the statement is night and day different than what it is in the states that are controlled by political parties.
Wow. And we're a state that's controlled by political parties.
We are. Now, Eastern Connecticut gave a very good representation of what it is outside of controlled parties.
No kidding.
Yeah. Eastern Connecticut was real strong in one particular direction.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite obvious what people want. And that Eastern Connecticut vote, everything east of the river, was very similar to the vote that you saw over in Rhode Island.
I wonder sometimes if Connecticut is going to split
We need to annex. We need to, you know, like have the east.
Not
of
annex. We're gonna the state is gonna divide in two, and there's gonna be East Connecticut and West Connecticut. And
Well, there already is. Politically, there already is.
Right. That everything west of the
and financially
west of the Connecticut River.
Yeah, yeah, financially,
west of the Connecticut River and east of the Connecticut River.
Oh, that's been going on for years.
Yeah, that because one is they should just call west of the Connecticut River, call it East New York.
Well, and then for all you baseball fans out there, there's the Red Sox fans on the eastern side of the river, and there's the Yankees fans on the and Mets fans on the western side
that
of the river.
That depends.
It does depend, but it is stronger in one side than it is on the other.
If you go to Westerly, Rhode Island, the town is divided in two.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, in Westerly, Rhode Island, which is all the way east of that.
Well, that's because there's a lot of transplants from New York that live in Westerly.
That's not it. That's not true.
Okay.
No,
all right.
No, because they hung out down there. It's not that people who live in Westerly, that was the issue.
I have a caller question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, that I got earlier from Calvin from Hampton.
All right.
And Calvin from Hampton, who is an avid listener, shout out to Calvin, said his daughter is moving to a new apartment and he would like to help her put some plants in the apartment, and he wants to buy her some plants that would be good for her health-wise.
Yes.
And i.e. like, you know, getting like a like an aloe plant, because obviously, you know, if you get a if you need some medicinary from the aloe, you can get that from the aloe plant. He wants to know if you would have a good list of ideas that he could purchase for her so he could give her some really nice plants for her apartment that would help her in the future.
Okay.
And he said it wouldn't be bad to also touch on outdoor plants as people are putting their gardens in outdoors too.
So,
question.
So aloe is a great plant because, you know, you can break open an aloe leaf and the flesh of the inside the aloe plant is very healing. It's very healing to epithelial tissue, linings and coverings. So it's very good for your skin. It actually happens to be very good internally, too. That's why aloe juice is a great curative for digestive upset.
There you go.
But if you burn yourself or you cut yourself or you just want your skin to be nice and soft and supple, aloe is great. And the best way to use aloe is to take it right from the plant. Take a piece of a leaf and scoop out the inside and put it right on.
Just rub it right on.
Yeah, it's really good for you. I mean, you can get aloe gel as pure as it can be, but it's always going to have some kind of additive in it. And that still is very helpful. But fresh from the aloe plant, that's the best way to go.
But why not grow it?
So aloe is a great way to go. Mm-hmm. Air quality plants, that's a biggie, especially if you're going to be indoors and if you're ever going to be indoors with the windows closed for a significant portion of time. There are some really particular plants that are really good for air quality. I'm reading here that the garden mum, that it moves, these remove specific chemicals from the air, like ammonia, benzene, formaldehyde, so you know, and xylene. So you know, this is interesting because formaldehyde and xylene are problems. They're problems in nail salons. So nail salons should have garden mums in them all
there
the time.
Go.
Yeah.
Nice.
So spider plant. You know, like that thing that
spider
keeps,
plant. Yeah.
That keeps losing its. We don't water it enough. And
yeah. Well,
but you still
know,
can't kill it.
We're abusive plant owners.
The nice thing about spider plants is they're hard to kill. You give them a little water and they grow and they make
are
babies.
Hard to kill.
But they are an air quality plant. They're actually good for your air quality. And they're hard to kill. So they're good for if you have a black thumb and you want to, nevertheless, you want to have some plants. You can try having a spider plant. Ficus is a big one. You know, it's related. Ficus is related to figs. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the ficus, it is a weeping fig, in fact. That plant is also a nice air quality plant. The peace lily is a good one. The Boston fern, a really beautiful plant that you can get at health food stores sometimes is the Gerbera daisy.
Yeah, I see that here. Yeah.
They're really pretty, and they come in all different colors, and they are a great air cleaning plant.
They remove trichloroethylene.
Ooh. Yeah. So we should go get us some Gerbera
daisies.
So
if you're a dry cleaning person and you bring home dry cleaning, you get that in your air and in your house, and this plant helps take that away.
Boston fern seems to be a biggie. Yeah.
Yeah.
What's a Boston? Do we have any Boston ferns?
We don't have any Boston ferns. My aunt has Boston ferns. She's always had Boston ferns.
Yeah.
They're a little tricky, I think.
Oh.
I may be wrong. I may be completely wrong. I don't know. Every plant is tricky for me, so it's hard to say.
They're really good. That's another one to put in the nail salon because they remove formaldehyde.
Oh, look at this snake plant. We have one of those.
We do.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they are really tough to kill. I'll tell you. That's one rugged, stubborn plant right there. But we have that I got from my mom years ago.
And don't forget the pothos, which is a really common house plant. Good old pothos. I think I had a pothos. I don't have a pothos now, but
formaldehyde again.
Yeah.
A lot of these go after formaldehyde. Now, formaldehyde, if you just had new cabinets put in your house or if you have had any kind of work done in your house, especially carpeting, there's formaldehyde in your house. It's definitely there unless you've been very, very cautious about what you bought. You have to be really careful about that sort of thing. Any kind of new construction, plywoods, particle boards, anything like that. There's a lot of formaldehyde in there. So
I think we should go out and get some Gerbera daisies. They're just so pretty and so cheery. I want some Gerbera daisies.
Chrysanthemums.
Chrysanthemums too. Yeah, mums. Mm, yeah, that's mums. What I'm saying.
Yeah.
Mums are really good. So we should have more
mums. I always think of them as a fall outside flower. I don't think of them as an inside.
But they're really good for air quality. So those are all some great suggestions. The aloe, and then of course garden herbs. That's another thing you can do. You can get her some culinary herbs to have, whether you want your basil or oregano or rosemary or lavender. Any of those would be good. We have to go.
Oh, look at that.
So you're listening to 91.7 FM, WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch. It's an interesting journey. We'll see what happens with our political situation and our environment. We are here to support you. Wash your sheets and your pillowcases. And if you're not allergic to it, you can try some local honey. And do clean your nose. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath. Here at WHUS 91.7 FM.